This is Rabbi Josh Yoder of the Stanton Street Shul. Thank you for downloading this class podcast. These classes are provided free of charge through the generosity of the Stanton Street Shul community and supporters like you. If you do enjoy them, please consider making a donation to our synagogue's building fund on our website's shop donate page at www.stantonstshul.com.
Good morning. It is April 6th, 2014. Continuing with laws of Shabbat and two little weird quirks for this morning. One, don't have source sheets because I had a printer problem late last night. It was too late for me to try to figure it out. I figured it would just be a lot easier to bring my own Rambam in. Two, in terms of topics, we'll see how much we can do today. Today might be a little bit shorter. To explain why, normally, like what we've seen before is Rambam doesn't divide each melacha, each category of labor, into its own chapter. Usually there's a combination of a few. In terms of editing, we can argue, like, would it make a little bit more sense to have, you know, clear-cut divisions? But you know what? When you're writing something like the Mishneh Torah, you know, in the early Middle Ages, we're not going to yell at him for not having an editor. But what it does mean is we're going to come to an interesting point of skipping around. We're up to chapter 12. In chapter 12, as we'll see in a second, he begins with the laws of kindling a fire. Okay? But in the middle of chapter 12, he switches over to the laws of carrying, which then takes over a whole bunch of other chapters. So when we go into those chapters, we are probably going to skip many of the laws and possibly even do them out of order, because the way that Rambam presents it has... I'm not going to say it doesn't make any sense, but I think a lot of it would be easier to understand if we started in certain places and did things in a different order, or maybe just do, you know, some other summary behind it. Because going straight through the laws of carrying would I think be very distracting to a lot of people, or by which I mean the goal was to have like a general overview of things. And when you get to the laws of carrying, there are a lot of details, you know, involving, well, you know, if one person carries this, another, like, you know, double carrying and stuff like that, you know, we'll go through, like, yes, carrying is prohibited. And we'll try to focus on the more relevant halachot. By relevant, I mean the things you are most likely to encounter. Most of the other stuff is certainly worthwhile by means of exceptions. Like if you get stuck in some emergency situation, and as I said, you know, many times before, you want to be mima et beisur. You want to minimize the amount of prohibitions that you know that you'd be doing. Knowing how to get around some stuff can be useful, right? But in terms of, you know, what people are going to retain. I mean, I have no idea what memory retention is for this. I don't give out quizzes. I just know the way that my strange mind works is that the more you focus or try to cram in there, the less is actually going to stay. So I'd rather people, you know, have more of a general overview and keep that and gradually supplement it with details rather than try to say, oh, you have to get all these details straight, and then you wind up not even understanding the general concepts. It's a pedagogic decision, not a dig on Rambam, not a dig on halacha. So hopefully we'll just do a chavrusa thing here and share the laws of Shabbat. So again, we're beginning with chapter 12, which starts us off with the laws of fire. All right, and he begins by, again, quantifying what is the minimal amount of fire you need to make in order to violate Shabbat.
A person who kindles even the smallest fire is liable, provided he needs the ash that he creates. However, should a person kindle a fire with a destructive intent, he is not liable, for he is causing ruin.
All right, so first off, also, welcome back, Sam. Mazel tov. Mary, finish off the Sheva Brachos. We won't say Gadishan because you probably have heard enough of that for the week. Yeah. So like we said before, in order to violate Shabbat biblically, it has to be a creative act, right? So if you just burn something down, right, if you're using the ashes, that's a creative act. Mm-hmm. If you are using it to destroy, that's not a creative act. And you remember the question that Mike asked, you know, a month or so ago about, well, what if you're a pyromaniac and you get a lot of pleasure behind it, just like injuring a person? Great question, but we'll hold off on that one, all right?
Nevertheless, a person who sets fire to a heap of produce or dwelling belonging to a colleague is liable because his intent is to take revenge on his enemies.
And there's your answer, right? So no vengeance on Shabbos.
Through this act, he calms his feelings and vents his rage. He is comparable to a person who rends his garments over a deceased person or in a rage on Shabbat, or a person who injures a colleague in an argument. These individuals are considered to be performing a constructive activity because of their evil inclinations. Similarly, a person who lights a candle or wood, whether to generate warmth or light, is liable. A person who heats iron in order to strengthen it by submerging it in water is liable for performing a derivative of the forbidden labor of kindling.
All right, so remember that last line we've also seen before regarding electricity, right? When you're heating up... you heat iron in order to strengthen it by putting it in water. Normally when you think of burning, right, it's a chemical reaction, right, where something is undergoing a change and you're totally changing the composition. When you're heating metal, I mean, please correct me on the science here because, you know, you're not making the same physical change, meaning you can heat metal and the metal is also going to cool down. Right? And it's still going to be metal. I mean, there's probably, you're heating up electrons, it's doing stuff in there, but it doesn't destroy the mass of the metal. Even so, there's something involved there regarding kindling, regarding fire. Hey! Welcome, joining us for Shiur? Awesome! Come on in! We just started discussing the laws regarding fire. We're passing around the books because printer error. Alright, so... Again, problem is not allowed to light any sort of fire of any sort of amount. The intention has to be constructive, meaning something positive has to come through it, either because you need the ashes that come out of it, or you're doing it because it makes you feel good. All right? So no pyromania on Shabbos. Let's just go around the other way. Read number two.
A person who extinguishes a fire... Even the small size is liable. This includes both one who extinguishes a candle, one who extinguishes a coal that comes from wood. In contrast, a person who extinguishes a glowing piece of metal is not liable.
Mm-hmm. Turn the pages. All right, so stop there for a second. So there are certain actions that we saw in earlier classes that have their opposite, like sewing and undoing sewing, writing and erasing. So just as igniting a fire is prohibited, you're not allowed to extinguish a fire. An important distinction, though, is if I'm burning a piece of wood, or like, you know, a piece of wood, I would say a match, right? Simplest thing, that is a piece of wood. So if I blow out a match, I've extinguished the flame. But by cooling off heated metal, even though the action of heating metal might violate a derivative of, you know, making a fire, I don't violate Shabbat if I cool it off because I haven't extinguished a fire. All right, so an important distinction there. So then you're just, you know, taking down the heat. Continue. There's more.
If, however, the person's intent is to purify metal, he is liable. This indeed.
Right, so if you're... Yeah, okay, sorry. Normally I stop off at end of paragraphs, but I can't see it from here. So continue.
this indeed is a practice of blacksmiths. They heat the iron until it goes into coal, extinguish it in water to seal it. This is the process of purification for which one is liable. It is a derivative of the category of forbidden labor of extinguishing. It is permissible to extinguish a glowing piece of metal in the public domain so that many people will not be injured by it. A person who pours oil into a burning lamp is liable for kindling. Similarly, a person who takes oil from a lamp is liable for extinguishing.
Okay, so a whole bunch of things here. First of all, remind me your name again?
Joe.
So thank you very much, Joe. Welcome.
Thanks.
Normally everyone has source sheets when I don't have printer errors and I actually print out the correct chapter. Anyway, so one is that when you extinguish the flame, right, with the metal part, there's an important caveat with that, too, in terms of what is your intention behind it. Two, and he's going to discuss a bit, what about public safety, right? So if it's in the public domain, you don't want people to get injured. The language of the Rambam is, one second, It says here mutar, permissible completely. It is a rabbinic prohibition involved. It is waived because of the danger, according to the footnote here. Although he also says in footnote 12, according to the Rambam, this applies only with regard to a glowing piece of metal and not to burning coal. The authorities who maintain that one is not liable for performing a malacha she'enit zricha l'gufa, however, would allow one to extinguish a burning coal in this instance. Because of the danger involved, the rabbinic prohibition against performing such an activity is waived. And Rambam is going to discuss a bit regarding the extinguishing part. But it can also be, as you know, Rambam continues here, is adding fuel is still a problem of burning. So too, removing fuel could be a matter of extinguishing. Right? Now, that you might not see as a direct action, but rather causative. Right? So if I've got, you know, we don't really have oil or, you know, stuff like that, but fuel sources. Let's say those who have, the best analogy I can think of is a pilot light. Right? If you've got one of those gas ovens, or at least the gas burner things, not the oven part, you've got a flame that's always there. Technically speaking, you're not creating fire. You're not extinguishing fire. When you, quote, turn on the gas, you are providing a fuel source. When you remove the gas or lower, you know, the flame, you are restricting the fuel source. So technically, you haven't actually, you know, ignited anything, and you haven't extinguished anything. You're manipulating the fuel source, and that causes the flame to go up and down. People might argue on my description with that. I'm using that by way of an analogy of manipulating the fuel source as itself being a problem. Corinne, number three.
Should a fire break out on the Sabbath, a person is liable if he extinguishes it because of fear of monetary loss. It is only the threat of loss of life and not monetary loss that supersedes the Sabbath prohibitions. Therefore, all people should leave the area of the blaze so they do not die. They should let the fire continue to burn, even if it consumes the entire city.
Right. Now, we can, like, so step one, and, you know, we'll talk about this because he gets a little bit more in detail, is you can extinguish it if there's a clear threat to life. What exactly is a clear threat to life? So Rambam here says, you know, if you've got time to run away, that's not a clear threat to life. You're supposed to run away because you can't just do it to save property, only people. So run away. Even if, right, the entire city burns down, if people can get out in time, get out in time. All right? Qualifications, though, like we're not stopping there. Lauren?
It is permissible to construct a barrier using any type of container, whether full or empty, so that a fire will not spread. One may even construct a barrier using new earthen vessels filled with water, although they will surely break and extinguish the fire. It is permissible to cause a fire to be extinguished indirectly. One may place a bowl over a candle so that the light will not catch on the beams of the roof.
All right. So this comes up a lot. If there's, you know, I mean, look. If someone has a fire in their house, usually people are not thinking of the details of Hilchot Shabbat. People are reacting instinctively. Okay? Also, has anyone here actually, like, put out a fire? I know there's a slight digression here. What?
Like a campfire.
Right. So, this past year, I did something called CERT, which stands for Community Emergency Response Team. I'm not sure exactly how useful it is in the city, but after Hurricane Sandy, I should learn a little bit more about emergency preparedness. The point of this organization, it's a division of the OEM, Office of Emergency Management. It's a way of training basically civilians or residents in emergency training. You're kind of like first responders. So, like, you can take care of, quasi-auxiliary people. You're basically civilians. You're not, like, actual trained, you know, EMT people. But you learn about really basic stuff across the board. One of the things that we had was an exercise in how to put up a fire using a fire extinguisher. They blocked off a portion of 19th Street, set up little fires in there, and we had to, you know, we actually used a fire extinguisher to spray. Something that's very important to know with these things is if you do it wrong, you actually wind up spreading fire. You're supposed to, you know, there's something called pass, like press, aim, you know, sweep side to side at the base. If you do it directly on it, the flames shoot out forward. So they gave us a lot of recommendations about, like, if it's a flame of this size, try it. Anything larger than something else, you just work on evacuation. Right? These are not things that people start, and the reason why you actually get trained in this in advance is when there's an emergency that happens, you know what to do, or at least you have a better idea of what to do instinctively that would prevent loss of life. Okay? Unfortunately, you know, a lot of accidents happen because they don't have proper training. They do something which they think makes sense at the time, and it's wrong. But if you get trained, right, you're not thinking of laws of Shabbat. You're thinking about, how do I get rid of this fire? Dana, we're on page 210.
Can I ask a quick question, grammatical question?
Oh, sure.
The page before,
yeah.
I think in the sentence about burning down a city,
yeah.
He says, kol dirato.
Yeah, kol dirato.
Dirato, he's translating as the whole city.
Means, I mean, technically it's the whole residences, or all of his residence. But yeah, I mean, that's a great point. Wow, good catch there. Yes, you know, if you lose sefer kol dirato, it really would mean the entire... let me see if he does the footnote here. So he elaborates here, in his time, it was common for the commotion caused by fire to serve as an invitation for Gentiles to raid the Jewish quarters of the city, rampaging, pillaging, and causing havoc. In such a situation, it was very possible that Jewish lives would be threatened. Hence, he maintained it was preferable for the fire to be extinguished than for a situation to be created. Furthermore, in the cramped conditions of the ghettos, it was highly possible that the lives of children, the elderly, and the disabled would be threatened by a fire. I started in the second paragraph there. Accordingly, he states, in the present time, it is permissible to extinguish a fire that has begun to blaze in a city, quoting the Ramah. But you are correct. The translation here is not accurate. It says, Afilu Sefer Kol Dirato only applies to his house. If it would apply to the entire city, that would only work, I mean, if the entire city could evacuate, then the entire city ought to evacuate. Realistically, I mean, especially today, you know, let's say New York, right? It's certainly in New York. We live in apartments. A small fire in one apartment can cause a great deal of loss of life. You're worried about everyone else on your floor, worried about everyone else above you. Even if you're not worried about direct fatalities or fatalities from the fire itself, people don't respond well in fires and often do silly things. Opening doors and windows and feeding. I'm not going to go into fire safety right now. Anyway, points here though. There are things that you can do. Like, let's say loss of life isn't an issue, right? You can set up barriers and boundaries such that you can contain a fire without manipulating the fire directly. All right? So let's say you've got a fire on your dining room table. Right, something that you would, be able to do is, you might have to go away, you know, do away with your table. And again, excuse me for messing up the science here. Let's say you had an asbestos container left over from the 40s, right? You could spray a perimeter around that table. Right? You couldn't extinguish the fire directly, but let's say you just did the perimeter, gave yourself a buffer, it would burn itself out within that area, and then you'd be okay. You might get cancer, but you'd be okay. Yeah.
Are people actually gonna take the time to think that through?
Right. So, like I was saying, technically, no. Let's say you do it anyway, right? In terms of how would you violate Shabbat in those situations, again, you could argue, based on the way that we live today, there is in fact an issue of pikuach nefesh even with a small fire. You live in suburbia. Most of our houses are built out of wood. A fire in one house can very easily catch and go to someplace else. You know, fire is something which... The Gemara does talk a lot about fire pertaining to damages. Even makes a distinction between a ruach mitzuyah and a ruach she'ena mitzuyah. And if there's a normal wind that catches fire, you know, it'll spread it in a certain direction versus a crazy wind that'll blow it in all other directions. Are you going to take chances with this? I don't know. You know, again, if it's a matter of, I think today when people extinguish a fire, people don't do a calculus of, I'm trying to save property versus I'm trying to save people. Right? It could depend on your situation. I don't know. If there's something that's actually ignited, people get nervous. Let me give you an analogy. Anyone here remember the Eat and Walk on 72nd Street? Right? All right. Does anyone here know what a poo-poo platter is? All right. A poo-poo platter, you know what that is? Poo-poo platter is a Chinese it's an appetizer you can get in Chinese restaurants. I used to love getting this because it's this like wooden, almost like a mini Lazy Susan with like little container thingies. Lots of different types of appetizers. And in the middle, you have this fire, like this thing of flame with one of those like heat gels, and it comes up. So I always used to like playing, it's like, oh, you know, heat the stuff on the tray there. And back in the day, you got really nice poo-poo platters. They came with spare ribs. It's really hard to find spare ribs. I don't know how spare ribs are Chinese food, but they were really good, and they're hard to find anymore. Anyway, I was at the Eat and Walk on 72nd with a friend, and mind you, we were splitting a poo-poo platter. Only problem was, one of the newly deep-fried egg rolls was too close to that flaming thing, and the whole thing ignited. So me and a friend were just incredibly nonchalant. Of course, it took a while to like get down a waiter. It's like, hey, and I was like, we think this is on fire. And eventually, they're like, ah! They took it, wound up giving us a new one, and behind us was clearly a couple on a shidduch date. That looked at us like we were crazy because we were just like, fire, whatever. Because it still seemed like small enough to be contained. We were not, did not have that great of a risk behind it, but that was also something that was kind of contained. Something that people might do with something like that. So here would be a good example. Would I be allowed to, let's say that happened on Shabbat, right? In terms of extinguishing the fire directly? Probably not. Here would be an alternative, though. Let's say taking that fire, if you can, right? Because, like, the whole thing is in a blaze, putting it in the sink. So you put it in the sink, eventually it's going to burn itself out, right? And in a sink that's, I would assume, sinks today you'll find either stainless steel or porcelain, right? It might do some damage to the sink, not a whole lot, or certainly not enough that you can care about, but it's a way of containing it. All right. So that would be one way of doing it. If it's a small contained fire that you're worried about spreading, perhaps that could be a way of dealing with it, especially because there is that potential risk and you're not directly extinguishing it. Right. But that's a contained one. If, let's say, you see a segment of your carpet is on fire, then you might think differently, even though it might be a smaller amount, because carpet fires spread very quickly. And if you've got other residents in the house, let's not forget, people don't always die from fire. They die from the smoke inhalation related to the fire, right? And if you've got chemical stuff burning, that's going to fill your house up. That's not good either, all right? So I don't think it's so much a function of, size. It's a function of risk, of, what might be more of a risk factor for killing people than others. And in terms of what protections can you take that would be reasonable. Because, in this case, let's not forget, Safik Pikuach Nefesh, right? Remember what Rambam said earlier, right? Very few people here are firemen or fire people. You ever take fire? You must have taken a fire safety class. Didn't CUNY make you do that?
It was once a fire warden, yeah.
You see? All right. So some people might have had training. Few people do. And, even professional fire people will tell you, you don't waste time trying to think of this sort of thing. If you really think that there's a possible danger and you react instinctively, are you going to be held halachically liable for that? Hard to say. Certainly not for, a beit din to punish you. And if this is the worst thing that you do, however God decides to punish, so be it. But it is important to consider, though, you have to be somewhat reasonable in terms of not every small thing can you just extinguish. Something's like, leave it, let it go. All right. Actually, a fun fact here. If you go all the way to the third floor of the shul, you will find a weird artifact of what looks like a white box with a chimney, like small little chimney attached to it. That box was a vestige of the time when you had families, like large families, living in small one-bedroom apartments. People would light their candles in that box. Because when you had partitions, you're partitioning off a one-bedroom apartment, you didn't have drywall like we do today with the Upper West Side. You hung like curtains or, you know, accordion things that were flammable. If a candle tipped over, you had flammable material all over your apartment. So you used to light it in there. In the event something tipped over, you wouldn't kill yourself and everyone in the building. Mesrich had stuff like that before the shul shut down. So if you go up to the third floor, you see what people used to do, again, in a way of, you know, preventing. So, What?
Do we not have handouts?
We do not have handouts because my printer did not work last night. Who are we up to, Lauren? Oh, you just did some. So.
Trump?
Yeah, so that's the whole thing that we were talking about. If it's a matter of pikuach nefesh, that's not a problem. It's just today, you know, what really counts as pikuach nefesh? Most of us are not trained for that, right? So if there's like a minimal risk, there are ways that you can extinguish a fire, or at least cause a fire to be extinguished that would not be problematic. If the only concern you have is property, that's an issue. Rambam in an early halacha seemed to say, if you could just run away from the fire, do that instead of trying to put it out. Today, right, I don't know, and in the footnotes, I mentioned the Ramah, you might argue that today our situations in terms of our buildings are very different than elsewhere. Even if you're out camping, right, you run away. But campfires tend to spread, right, and unfortunately cause a great deal of loss of life. Everyone here knows Smokey the Bear. Anyone know of the equivalent in England? They have a frog. Mitch Hedberg has a whole thing about that.
Yeah.
Excellent! And you know the whole routine there?
Yeah.
It's like, he makes it. You know what? He does a better job. Look up Mitch Hedberg on that. Anyway, number five.
When a fire catches onto a perfume box, a chest, or a wooden cabinet, one may bring a goat skin or another substance that will not catch fire and spread it over the portion that has not been consumed so that the fire will not reach there.
Right, so another way of doing it, like, again, one way is you can, like, build a moat. You can spray asbestos, again, like we mentioned earlier. Not wise for other reasons, but if you put down non-flammable material surrounding an area, well, you know what? If that's what you can do, okay. Again, if there's a real risk of loss of life, don't bother doing that. Law six, when a garment that is folded catches on fire, one may spread it out and don it. If in process the fire is extinguished, it is not significant. Similarly, if a Torah scroll has caught fire, one may unroll and read from it. If in the process the fire is extinguished, it is not significant. One may place water on the portion that has not yet caught fire. If in the process it is extinguished, it is not significant. We have a nice Fahrenheit 451 reference here. Also, there's that midrash that the Torah was initially a black fire written on white fire, so it shouldn't matter. There are a whole bunch of more jokes you can make about this. Like, why are you reading from a Torah scroll that's on fire? Irrelevant for the moment. If a person left a burning candle on a board, one may shake the board and cause the candle to fall. If it is extinguished, it is not significant. If he intentionally placed it down before nightfall, it is forbidden to move the board even after the candle is extinguished. Footnote here is our translation is a slight extension of the actual text of the Mishnah Torah, which states "letaltalo," concluding with the masculine suffix that seemingly refers to the candle rather than the board. Nevertheless, as the commentaries point out, it is self-evident that the candle is forbidden to be moved. The new concept brought out by this law is that since the candle was intentionally left on the board before the commencement of the Sabbath, as explained in chapter 25, Halacha 17, which we are not up to, the board is considered the base of for a forbidden object and is also muktza. Okay? So, that's not, again, no longer in the realm of emergencies. All right? Seven?
If a fire broke out on Shabbat and a Gentile comes to extinguish it, we may not tell him, extinguish it, nor must we tell him, do not extinguish it, for his resting is not our responsibility. In contrast, should a child desire to extinguish the fire, he should not be allowed if he is acting on his father's behalf. If he is acting on his own initiative, the court is not obligated to restrain him. In the instance of a fire, our sages permitted a person to say, anyone who extinguishes the fire will not suffer a loss.
Right, and the footnote here says, as long as one does not instruct a Gentile to extinguish the fire, one may indirectly encourage him to do so. Since the Gentile has not been promised anything specific, he is considered working on his own behalf. So let's say your house is ablaze, and the fire department comes down to put it out. You're under no obligation. It's like, yeah, you know what, let it burn. Right, you don't have that issue here. Again, important to remember here, fire safety is really, really, really important. In the class that I had from CERT, the head guy behind it was actually, it was a captain at least. And there were a whole bunch of crazy, crazy stories about, there was about fire, and we spent several classes on that, and either people doing ridiculous things, or one instance where there was a fire on a table that had some sort of pad, and they called, the woman called 911. The fire was out, but she wanted to file a report that there was a fire, and just to make sure, the guy just lifted the pad, whoosh, whole thing went up. There was some like ember there, and the new thing of oxygen just ignited the whole thing. Anyone here see the movie Backdraft? Mm-hmm. Right? See the movie Backdraft if you haven't yet, because a lot of stuff can happen even if you think that it's safe. So fire safety is certainly important. There are certain rules regarding extinguishing that you are not supposed to do. If there is some situation where a fire that broke out that you need to contain, you're talking about like matter of seconds. If there's an easy way of doing it, fine. If you do it out of, instinct of like, not thinking straight, you might even come under category of shkaga. Because you're just, again, not intentionally trying to break Shabbat. You're like, I have to get this out. And again, we're dealing today, legitimately, I think, and this is a matter of, this would be more a matter of psak than halacha, in that, reasonable people can argue reasonably about how to apply the halacha. We can all agree that extinguishing a fire is prohibited, certainly to preserve property, but it's prohibited to preserve property, but permitted to preserve life. As a matter of psak, I would argue that if a fire gets out of control, in terms of how to define it, we were told in the class if it's larger than a waste paper basket fire, then you start evacuating and stuff like that, because then it becomes more that your typical person with a spray thing will be able to handle. But even so, given the situations with how we live today, given the multiple of risks involved, I would sooner err on the side of caution. Given, again, certainly if you're living in apartments, you got a whole lot of neighbors to worry about. You're living in houses, you got your neighbors to worry about. You're out camping, you've got a lot of trees out there. Maybe if you're out in the desert, your risk factors will go from one place to the next. But if it's in a house situation, there's so many things that can catch fire. And between the fire itself and the smoke inhalation next to that, because again, that's what kills people a lot more than burning. It's dying from smoke inhalation, passing out, and asphyxiation. These things are not pleasant. They are very real. There was a study there. There was a crazy quick thing there about how a sofa ignited, especially one with cheap foam. The stuff gets out of hand very, very quickly. Right, so in my personal opinion of psak, one of the rare times I'm going to do it here, and I'm sure other people might disagree, given how we live today, even a small out-of-control fire is probably an issue that, you're better off extinguishing in order to save someone's life. If it's a small one, let's put it this way, if it's small enough that you think you can handle halachically by, nudging it over, fine. Anyone wants to, if it's a matter of candles, incidentally, one easy way of fire prevention, which I recommend every Hanukkah, is if you light your candles in, say, an aluminum tin thing, such that if it happens to get knocked over, it would fall off in the tin, right? And then it'll just burn itself out and you're completely fine. All right? So there are certain things you can do from a preventative measure not to have that. You seem perplexed.
We can't necessarily predict in what direction a fire is going to go.
No, but that's why it's, you know, a mode of prevention, right? Yes, I mean, that's the difference between the Ruach Mitzuyah and the Ruach She'ena Mitzuyah. According to the Gemara, right, the Desea Ruach Mitzuyah is, here's how things normally work. If you've got, let's say, a rambunctious dog or a cat, right, they, you know, have a full steam, you know, run into the candles, you can get some distance on that stuff, right? That's, I mean, candles could also be different than, you know, tea lights or whatever that have some liquid thing there. Who knows? That, you know, you can do a certain measure of prevention, but there's only so much you can do. Or let's say there's an earthquake. You live out in San Francisco, right? You can have normal prevention. No, well, I can't say no one predicts earthquakes, but they're usually unexpected. In the event of an earthquake, you don't, like, you can take normal precautions, right? And again, normal precautions are good for normal scenarios. The abnormal ones, well, you have to deal with those then, all right? But fire safety is also very, very important. Yeah.
So, slightly off topic, if you say to a non-Jew something like, there's a fire over there and it's our Jewish Sabbath, so we're not allowed to put it out.
Yeah.
Let's assume he takes the hint, puts it out. Are you allowed to say thank you to him? Because thank you basically implies you've done this for me rather than...
No, I don't think that's about... You're acknowledging good work. I mean, you could say thank you, like, I'm acknowledging that you did something positive, yeah. Right? I can thank someone... Look, that frequently, I thank people not because I get personal benefit, but because someone else got personal benefit. Like, if I see one person do something nice, I'll say, oh, thank you for doing nice for someone. You can it's an expression of gratitude for a job well done, regardless of whether or not you personally benefited from it, or if it was done on your behalf. Though I would put in, you know, something else here. Remember, Amira La'akum, telling a non-Jew to do something, is rabbinically prohibited, right? Now, remember what we said before, stacking, rabbinic prohibition attached to a rabbinic prohibition, right? Telling a non-Jew to tell a non-Jew to do something, in theory, would be permitted. Practically speaking, this would mean, if there's a fire, I call 911, who's actually telling the firemen, hey, put out this fire? Not me, I'm telling the dispatcher, right? So even in that scenario, call, in my opinion, again, this is a sock matter, which again, people are free to disagree with this. My understanding is, again, I'm only, the prohibition about me telling a non-Jew to do labor is rabbinic, but me telling a non-Jew to tell another non-Jew to do labor is a trade the rabbanan. You're stacking rabbinic prohibitions that then becomes permissible because I'm telling a non-Jew, right, to do, tell a non-Jew, I'm basically telling a non-Jew to do a rabbinic prohibition of Amir La'akum. And when I call a dispatcher, I'm not telling the non-Jew to put it out. Technically speaking, you're not even telling the dispatcher, you know, hey, come put out my fire. You're telling them, hey, I got a fire here, right? So my understanding is, even according to the Rambam, if you're going to be strict, and you don't want to put out the fire, or, like a reasonable person, you think, hey, I just need to get out. You get out and you call 911. I don't think that's a problem. Certainly not in America, where most of the firemen are Jews. When you're dealing in Israel, most of the people you're dealing with are Jewish, whole other separate, you know, laws. But when you're dealing in a place where your dispatcher most likely isn't going to be Jewish, which is a fair assumption in America, the firemen are typically not going to be Jewish, again, a very fair assumption in America. My opinion, as a matter of psak, you would have no problem at all calling 911 regarding a fire. Yeah.
The calling itself should be problematic.
The calling itself would be problematic. Well, it depends on...
We run out in the street and say, hey, get a fireman out of my house.
We haven't quite gotten there yet in terms of what are the prohibitions about using phones yet. You know, remember, the whole electricity thing takes a while and what that means for our own cell phones. But let's say, you know, you've got a... let's say you've got, like, policemen nearby. Right? Or even something like that. Right? Making someone aware of a fire, right? Or like waving was like, hey, there's a fire, right? Should be fine. Everyone's saying it's like, hey, fire, call 911, like running out. Well, that would be, you know, fine.
Turn to Sanhedrin. What were houses made of? Stone?
More stone and earthenware than other stuff.
Would that have shaped the way they approached?
That's kind of what the Ruma says. It's also not just, you know, what they were made out of, but also how they were connected to each other. And what was the type of stuff that you had in your house? Let's not forget, the stuff that we have is not only a lot more flammable, it's a lot more toxic. Because we've got a lot of, you know, synthetics in our apartments.
Yeah.
Right. So there are a whole bunch of factors involved here. I'm not sure if they knew of smoke inhalation. Right. It may not have been as much of a problem if you're just dealing with wood. Although some places, you know, where they've got wood burning ovens indoors, not the healthiest of environment to live in. So they might have known a little bit about it, but probably not to the same extent that we know today. So who's ever doing the calculus behind it really needs to take into account smoke inhalation from fire. All right. So, alright, so this took us for a while again. We're not going to meet for next bunch of weeks because of Pesach. Keep an eye out for the schedule when classes resume. And we will pick it up next time, beginning with the laws of carrying. Again, we're probably going to go out of order and do some skipping because it gets into very complicated details. But that's going to be Rambam for the remainder of chapter 12 and for the next bunch of chapters. Alright? Have a wonderful week, and if I don't see you, happy Pesach!